Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, I'm very pleased and honored to have as my guest Toni Morrison, who has been on the show once before. Once again, we are speaking to her by phone to her home in New York, and the occasion is the publication of her new novel, Love. She is the author, of course, in reverse order, of Paradise, Jazz, Beloved, Tar Baby, Song of Solomon, Sula, and The Bluest Eye. Those are her novels. I wanted to begin by saying that it struck me that people are needing several years to read Jazz, to read Paradise, and now Love, because the books seem to me to be extremely brilliant and complex in their organization. This book, Love, seems to me to be about time and place, the way in which, depending on who you are and when you are there, your experience changes who you are, what love is, and what you know. The setting of this place has once been a resort. The people in the resort have moved into a home on Monarch Street. They are in an area that has been once an oceanside, but now there's a place called Oceanside, not by an ocean, with very cheap government housing. Other places that people remember are covered now by water. The place that we're hearing about so vibrantly does not exist except in memory, and the book seems to be about the way love is a collection of the pieces that people can assemble. Even when they can't speak to one another, the reader assembles love. Is that correct?
Very, very close. What came to mind as you were talking was the idea I had of the way crystal forms. You know, you have a small piece and then it expands to another, and another layer comes on in a different shape, but it's all the same material. And when you get it finished, it's different facets, different light, looking at one simple thing.
Now, how does one go about, I know that it is in a sense a presumptuous question, because one never asks a magician about a particular trick, and it's even wrong to think of it as a trick, but the book seems to have been constructed in a very unusual way. That is to say, I don't know the words for it, but it seems that there are gists for each character, and in each section there's a passing of impulse almost, so that one character reports on the previous one's experience and then extends it. Were there diagrams? Well, how did you work?
No, I had diagrams for groups of people and rooms and streets. But the structure basically was how to reveal this responsibility that this man, Bill Cozy, was given all these roles, and how his life and his entrepreneurship affected, destroyed, helped, remade a set of people who lived in that community. So he is sort of not really on stage. Everything has to accrue sort of around him. And in order to describe how and whether and what was possible in terms of the range of kinds of love in the book, that I had this collection of people who knew him and each other in different ways, and had a terrible time trying to articulate this.
Now, you mentioned crystals, and I noticed that there were certain constellations that seemed permanent in the book, but from group of characters to group of characters. We have a couple who are raising their granddaughter, and also in the house, we have a very similar situation with a granddaughter who has come. Her grandfather is now dead. Her mother has been put in a home. The sense of how generations mirror one another through layers of time and space.
Well, it's true. It's that the past of one is very much connected to the past of the other. And across generational lines, there is a, or at least in the book, I wanted to stress what happens when you can't talk between those lines. Well, I'm thinking a lot in this book about the connection between love and language. And I wanted to have the narrator, the woman who opens and closes the book and intervenes in it, be a person who understands how precious language is. And it was interesting to me that she only says three or four things to the characters and styles herself as a woman who was always quiet, but she's talking constantly to the reader, constantly going on and on. And for her, some things were unspeakable, I think. And for the others, theirs was not unspeakability. It's just a frozen language. They have no language to talk to one another. But the ability to speak, to use, she says, if they only understood how precious the tongue was, to be able to say or to reveal or to admit or to, which is a way of knowing. And they're never able to do that until they get rid of the hovering excuse they had for not coming together, which was Bill Cozy.
Now, the book seems to be arranged so that the narrator, Toni Morrison, or how to put this, how, so that Toni Morrison can be separate from several different narrators, and that the structure should emerge almost on its own. The author is in charge of charting a crystalline growth, say, or an accumulation. So, for instance, we will watch a woman leave home on the way to her lawyer's office. She has an idea. By the time she reaches that office, a very brief scene, we've gone through several of her lives and marriages, and it's all been, in a sense, immaculately stage-managed. The amount of background that gets compressed into each scene. It's not just a matter of linkages. It's a matter of knowing how to manage the house so that the hotel at the center of the book is something really for a novelist. In a hotel, many people are living, and it takes the efforts of an entire staff to chart who's on the dance floor, who's a performer, who's in the kitchen, who's cleaning, who's made up the menus for this day's special, who's hidden the will, who's hidden the deed, where will this all go? And it's almost as if the Toni Morrison implied by this book is a vast staff of arrangers whose job is to get everything immaculately in place and then disappear.
I hope I disappeared. I hope I did. Well, you know, my feeling is that the plot, the lean plot, is information. This is what happens. But the meaning of a novel is in the structure. the question of when the information is given, at what time, what you want the reader to not just know but feel about this character, and then to learn more. And that's when the crystal begins to take its shape. Just writing the beginning, the middle, the end is one way to do it. It's not very interesting to me because it's not really lifelike. I mean, we don't live lives in plots. We sometimes retell ourselves the narrative of our lives that way, in a chronological way, but it doesn't happen to us that way. We learn something today that clarifies something 10 years ago, or we think the most momentous thing that ever happened was something that happened yesterday or 20 years ago, only to learn that it was part, really, of something else, or that it wasn't momentous at all. So that the way in which the mind takes in the varieties of experiences of life and other people has to be reassembled for its meaning. And that's where the structure, at least what I work very hard at, is the sort of deep structure. What is there underneath this activity? And then you see it from another person's point of view, not just one character, but another's, and how and when that information becomes available to the reader seems to me to be the real adventure.
It seemed to me that we come to understand of this group, as several others in your books, that their identities are dependent upon their relations to one another.
Absolutely.
And that they may often, for private reasons, want to conceal those relationships. They may be the subjects of scandal. And so truth is about what conceals identity in some strange way. And the working of this book, at least, is to watch. I thought of interconnected cogs like watchworks, to watch these cogs turning until they turn so carefully with such jewel-like design that their arrangement allows the reader to see a whole beyond the purview of any single figure.
Right,
yes.
Exactly. Yeah, we get them, if we're careful in the reading, you get the whole sort of back of the clock as well as the face, as it were, and you see them working and depending on one another so completely for almost every movement, every thought, whether it's back and forth or whirling or what have you. I like that notion of the cogs. It gives me another way to think and talk about it. But there are no isolated people. There's no one who, I mean, they may feel separate, but everything they do and think is connected to the behavior or what they think was the reason for the behavior of somebody else.
We get the sense, really, that the only way to know, even within a single consciousness, is to assemble the whole. Now, would you be willing to tell me how one, in what way you think of the whole in this book? What are they reaching toward?
The title.
Love.
Love. But not just carnal, or, you know, the way we normally talk about it is reduced to its lowest common denominator, but that human instinct to care for somebody else, whether it comes from Roman as a teenager who doesn't even know that he wants to rescue, but he can't help it and is ashamed of it, or whether it's appetite, or whether it's parental love, or the love of a father, as Cozy had for his son, or the love of the grandfather trying to explain in some comprehensible language, give advice to his grandson, or just that closeness of two children that is so close they're like invisible friends, and the sort of wide spirited love that L has for them all, which is not, it's sort of unconditional, but it has some certain conditions because she's perfectly willing to judge them very sternly. But she obviously is not going to abandon them. As a matter of fact, she takes steps to make sure that they are not abandoned, no matter how silly or stupid they may at some point appear to her to be.
Now, I'm beginning to understand this. Is it possible, then, that for each of these characters, there's a defining love? Cozy's for his son, perhaps Billy Boy.
And then his mistress.
And that other simulacra, other mirages of love.
All kinds. May is just terrified of the revolution coming. She will lose her place, the property, her move into another status. The girls are shattered, not only because they've been separated, but they have been trained to hate one another, which is a little bit different from just being split apart. And then there is an abiding love of the L character. And then there is a nice sort of companionship of the grandparents, who are Roman's grandparents. And then there is this little broken girl, Junior, who had no opportunities, really, to experience it, except for one tiny moment when Roman lifts her broken foot up and caresses it, and she feels this strange alien thing that makes her giddy. She doesn't even know what it is. It's almost like trust, not big enough to be called love, but it's the beginning of something. And then, so that, you know, this urgency, this thing we want to be, someone should love us, and also we have to love somebody, and that's the simple way of saying it, but when you take it apart and look at it closely, that's what they were all yearning for and having difficulty achieving, responding to, and clarifying. So I did run through that manuscript carefully after I finished it and knew what the title would be, and remove every word every time love appeared, so that it would be raw when the first time those women say it is the only time they could say it.
Yes. Yes, and what happens is ultimately there are replacements for love that they try use, but and love is a hugely uncomfortable thing. And so in one case, that love between young girls becomes the hatred between those two women.
Right.
And that hatred replaces their love.
Exactly.
But binds them together.
Right. They're still there.
Yes.
Can't live without one
in
another.
In the same house.
Right.
Oh, my goodness. So these, in other words, there is for each of these relationships a spectrum of alternatives to love that they, in other words, they desert love.
Exactly. They abandon it, and it morphs into this other thing.
Yes.
Junior, hers is hunger. She's just eating all the time.
Yes.
Trying to fill up. Roman is embarrassed by the first one until he is able to, you know, claim himself with her, but it's something that doesn't go away. It might even be natural to him. So that, you know, it's true, you can, appetite can take the place of that feeling he had when he was at that party. It's true that Junior can, you know, knowing that it was all her, she's the only one she can trust is herself. So she's constantly looking for more things to eat. And the women are there in this frozen, clear silence together.
This is Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm. I'm speaking with Toni Morrison about her newest novel, Love. The characters are going to replace love with something that feels stronger than mm-hmm. it to them. Mm-hmm. Envy, mm-hmm. hatred, mm-hmm. jealousy. Mm-hmm.
Love is scary to them.
And so now, what in relation to this is that empty resort?
Well, it is, I suppose, the culmination of something that started out with a certain kind of love on the part of Bill Cozy, which was to have this fabulous place that was for good times.
The best good times. That's right.
This side of the law. And to see that slowly drain away for a number of reasons, you're right. It wasn't only that black people didn't have to go there anymore. It wasn't only that he was distracted after his son died and married this little girl because he had the license to do it. He could act out a whim because his mistress left town. Or it wasn't only because May was so destructive in her terror. And it wasn't only because of his choice of a bride. It was a combination of things. But what sucked up all their, ambition about loving one another was turning their attention to him.
Mm.
He was the one who authenticated them. He was the one whose legacy they fight over. He was the one who ruined their lives beyond repair. Or he was the one, and they lie about him to themselves all the time. And he probably wasn't thinking about any of them. But the point is that they were complicit in that movement of constantly making him the big daddy, the one who did it all. And everything was his fault, and therefore you did this, and you did this, and you did this, until they finally exorcise him. But in any case, they're at the point now where nothing but language will save them, and that's when you can say, L-O-V-E.
Yes, now, it seems to me then, to go back to my observation at the beginning, that people are almost needing years to interrogate these novels, these more recent novels. It seems as if a novel is something like a haunted house, that its relation to the present, that as we live with a novel longer, as it becomes older, as it is no longer new and populated with characters who are new to us, but rather, as time goes on, with ghosts, we start to know where the bodies are buried.
Right.
We start to know what ghosts need attention, need to be bombed. And it's almost as if what the time spent by a novel in its culture is about healing that novel. In other words, the problems are not solved in the novel, but are solved, in a sense, by time and the position of the reader
exactly.
who was asked to explore the haunted house until it can be freed of its ghosts and re-inhabited. Yes?
Yes, and then the epiphany. I mean, it's true, you know, if you will just, as a reader, open the door or see an open door, step in and look around. No, you don't know who this is right away. No, you don't know who that is. No, you may not know what that room is for. If you like it, you'll go further. If you're afraid of it, you'll step out. Maybe you'll go back in later at another time. And then maybe you'll run around the whole house and get the lay of the land. And then later you'll go back into that house, and now you can see something else, something different. Now you don't have to worry about what's going to happen.
Mm.
Now you can just enjoy the place where these things happened and understand far more than the characters ever did about what this place is. And the more familiar it becomes, my hope is that it doesn't become gross, that it's still interesting to look in these nooks and crannies, to have that visceral response, as well as this sort of cognitive, intellectual response to how this whole thing is put together.
So in other words, that for the book, as for some of these characters, clarity brings resonance.
Absolutely. You know, it, for me, that's the reason one reads again. I mean, and I'm sure you have books that you read one year and later on you read them again and it's a different book, or it appears to be. It isn't. You've changed, perhaps, or you know more now, or you're looking for something else other than the obvious, other than, you know, the what happens. And that, you know, the only other thing I know, well, I'm sure there are many other things, but the one that comes closest to mind is, in addition to becoming familiar with and interested in a house, it's also music, in which you hear a song when you're 17 and then you have a powerful reaction in one way, you hear it later, you have another reaction, but what you're reacting to is the same piece of music, perhaps done in different hands, but your memories of it the first time you encountered it, as well as what you're thinking now, and so how it's worth listening to again.
That is so interesting, because one of these characters thinks to herself that mood indigo will help someone swim.
It's seductive, right?
Yes, it will take the rhythm. And one thinks of mood indigo, if one's listening to its words,
uh-huh.
as one that would impede passage. You ain't been blue,
right.
And so, yes, after you've lived with the words long enough, you hear the force and the structure.
Right, exactly so.
Well, it's been a real pleasure to talk to you again. I've really enjoyed it.
It's always a delight talking to you. You are really such a first-rate reader. I mean, it's lovely.
Well, I'm grateful to have the work of a truly extraordinary novelist to read.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. I've been talking with Toni Morrison, author most recently of Love. You can read an excerpt from Love, which is published by Knopf, on the Bookworm page at kcrw.com. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The technical director is Reg Warna. Special production assistance from Alan Howard and Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. Archived editions of this and other Bookworm programs can be found online at kcrw.com, keyword bookworm. Cassette copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme.
Now it's book. Off the mouse. Pop.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.